أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Sufi Reflections. On a regular, irregular basis, this podcast is intended, God willing, to introduce you to a wide variety of commentaries, ideas, stories, essays, discussions, interviews, and perspectives concerning not only the Sufi path or tasawwuf, but life in general as well. Through fact, fiction, possibilities, questions, and reflections, this podcast seeks to engage you on a journey of discovery in relation to issues and themes of relevance and significance to everyday life. I am not a sheikh, but I have, by the grace of Allah, been on the Sufi path for over 30 years, and I have benefited greatly by working closely with a Sufi saint of the 20th century for nearly two decades. This podcast is not about trying to guide people on the path, but rather to share some of what I and others have learned in conjunction with pursuing a Sufi way of life. My name is Bill Whitehouse, and God willing, I shall be your host for Sufi Reflection. In short, the Sufis are unanimous in recognizing the existence of mortification and discipline, but hold that it is wrong to pay regard to them. Those who deny mortification do not mean to deny its reality, but only to deny that any regard should be paid to it, or that anyone should be pleased with his or her own actions in the place of holiness. Inasmuch as mortification is the act of human beings, while contemplation is a state in which one is kept by God, and a person's actions do not begin to have value until God keeps him or her thus. The mortification of those whom God loves is the work of God in them, without choice on their part. It overwhelms and melts them away, but the mortification of ignorant people is the work of themselves, in themselves, by their own choice. It perturbs and distresses them, and distress is due to evil. This is from the writings of Hazrat Al-Hujwiri. May Allah be pleased with him.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
إِذَا السَّمَاءُ انشَقَّتْ وَأَذِنَتْ لِرَبِّهَا وَحُقَّتْ وَإِذَا الْأَرْضُ مُدَّتْ وَأَلْقَتْ مَا فِيهَا وَتَخَلَّتْ وَأَذِنَتْ لِرَبِّهَا وَحُقَّتْ
When the heaven is split asunder and attentive to her Lord in fear, and when the earth is spread out, and hath cast out all that was in her, and is empty, and attentive to her Lord in fear.
Ya ayyuhal insanu innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaqih فَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوتِيَ كِتَابَهُ بِيَمِينِهِ فَسَوْفَ يُحَاسَبُ حِسَابًا يَسِيرًا وَيَنْقَلِبُ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهِ مَسْرُورًا وَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوتِيَ كِتَابَهُ وَرَاءَ ظَهْرِهِ فَسَوْفَ يَدْعُو ثُبُورًا وَيَصْلَىٰ سَعِيرًا إنه كان في أهله مسرورا إنه ظن أن لن يحور بلى إن ربه كان به بصيرا
Thou verily, O man, art working toward thy Lord, a work which thou wilt meet in his presence. Then whoso is given his account in his right hand, he truly will receive an easy reckoning, and will return unto his folk in joy. But whoso is given his account behind his back, he surely will invoke destruction, and be thrown to scorching fire. He verily lived joyous with his folk. He verily deemed that he would never return unto Allah. Nay, but lo, his Lord is ever looking on him.
فَلَا أُقْسِمُ بِالشَّفَقِ وَاللَّيْلِ وَمَا وَسَقَ وَالْقَمَرِ إِذَا اتَّسَقَ لَتَرْكَبُنَّ طَبَقًا عَنْ طَبَقٍ فَمَا لَهُمْ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ وَإِذَا قُرِئَ عَلَيْهِمُ الْقُرْآنُ لَا يَسْجُدُونَ بَلِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا يُكَذِّبُونَ وَاللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِمَا يُوعُونَ فَبَشِّرْهُمْ بِعَذَابٍ أَلِيمٍ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَهُمْ أَجْرٌ غَيْرُ مَمْنُونَ
I swear by the afterglow of sunset, and by the night and all that it enshroudeth, and by the moon when she is at the full, that ye shall journey on from plain to plain. What aileth them then that they believe not? And when the Quran is recited unto them, worship not Allah? Nay, but those who disbelieve will deny, and Allah knoweth best what they are hiding. So give them tidings of a painful doom, save those who believe and do good works, for theirs is a reward unfailing.
One of the features that, God willing, will run fairly regularly on this podcast is a segment entitled Sufi Essays. As the title suggests, these pieces will be commentaries, sometimes brief and sometimes longer, about a variety of topics which, hopefully, may provide you with some thoughts on which to reflect. The following essay is entitled Identity. Knowledge is of two kinds. Formal knowledge, which does not go beyond verbal profession. It is the evidence of God against those people who profess such knowledge, and according to it, God will judge them. And, on the other hand, genuine knowledge, which is deep-rooted in the heart. This is the knowledge which is most useful. The foregoing has been attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. To go through life and never know who one is, this is a tragedy, both of modern as well as ancient times. Yet most of us would rather hold on to the ignorance and darkness of our egos instead of risk experiencing the temporary psychological and emotional discomfort which may be necessary to seek and discover the truth about ourselves. In our heart of hearts, even if we might not be willing to admit so to others, many of us realize that one of the primary activities of our egos is to generate misery, difficulty, and heartache, both for ourselves as well as others. Yet we permit ourselves and others to be subjugated to its cruel reign of tyranny again and again and again. In fact, we are such slaves too, and in fear of our egos, we are willing to forego all chance of having real, essential purpose, meaning, and identity enter into our lives. We would rather continue to permit ourselves to be crushed beneath the constant cravings and selfishness of our respective false selves. We live in the darkest shadows of a king or queen who rules arbitrarily and consistently uses tactics of manipulation, coercion, terrorism, corruption, seduction, and bribery. We dream of escape or revolution, but we cannot bring ourselves to take the steps to journey towards being our own person. We prefer the binding chains shackling us to the identity of the false self over the efforts required to learn how to use the keys within us to unlock our chains forever. We shy away from our spiritual identities because we believe this would condemn us to some sort of slavery to divinity. Yet we have these worries while we go about busily degrading ourselves as a lackey and a thrall of our false selves. The false self tells us, "Come with me, and you will be free of God." However, the false self never explains how we are to be free of it. At best, the false self is like an air traffic control system. As we leave one sector of our being, our ego will turn us over to the appropriate controller in the next sector. Nonetheless, all of the controllers are part and parcel of the same controlling system of the false self. They merely have different names, titles, and appearances. We never will be permitted to fly without filing a flight plan with and getting approval from the air traffic control system of the ego. The only flight plans which will receive approval are those traveling along the network of habitual routes laid down by the dialectic of passion and anger. To control ourselves or others is in the nature of the ego. Any inclinations we may have to seek our essential identity will always be resisted by the ego. Many aspects of modern and ancient philosophical, religious, psychological, and scientific thinking is and has been directed towards exploring the issue of human identity. Who are we as individuals? Who are we collectively? What does it mean to be a human being? What is entailed by or follows from the human condition? Where do we come from? Where are we going? What is the meaning and purpose, if any, of human existence? There are many conceptual and psychological currents which shape our interpretation of the nature of identity and the sort of role it plays or should play in our lives. Religion, culture, socioeconomic status, family life, education, career, race, ethnicity, age, gender, personal history, sexual orientation, nationality, success, and failure are all thought to have significant contributing roles in the shaping of identity. From the perspective of the Sufi masters, most of the normal ways of addressing the problem of identity often are preoccupied with largely marginal, if not illusory, considerations. More specifically, according to Sufi masters, we are all born with an innate spiritual nature and identity. However, our parents, and by extension our families, communities, schools, countries, and ourselves, make us into something other than what is indicated by our indigenous spiritual identity. Furthermore, practitioners of the Sufi path maintain all people are equal before God. Part of the meaning of this equality is that, from the perspective of divinity, qualities such as race, ethnicity, language, power, gender, status, fame, wealth, education, beauty, and so on, play no role in matters of gaining spiritual proximity, so to speak, to God. The elimination of the foregoing qualities from our spiritual curriculum vitae means those properties have nothing to do with spiritual identity in and of itself. On the other hand, such qualities do constitute a network of tests, trials, challenges, traps, opportunities, and obstacles which must be successfully navigated in order to arrive at the real core of identity, namely our essential spiritual nature. We can know whom we are, ethnically, racially, religiously, educationally, socioeconomically, historically, nationally, sexually, culturally, and politically. Nonetheless, according to Sufi masters, all of this is useless information because in and of itself, such information does not help us to realize ontologically whom we are in any spiritually essential sense. To the extent we get bogged down in these sorts of identity issues, then all our energies, time, resources, efforts, and focus will be diverted from discovering the real source and nature of our identity. Moreover, entanglements in all of the foregoing sort of traditional identity issues just become venues for getting lost, confused, frustrated, and seduced with respect to what our more fundamental purposes, goals, and needs of life should be. Such preoccupations are not in our best spiritual interests. Furthermore, in light of all the bloodshed and misery which is generated through conflicts and antagonisms involving these trappings of identity, this kind of identity preoccupation is not in the best spiritual interests of our families, communities, countries, or the world. Each of us has a unique spiritual identity. The nature of that identity may share certain common dimensions with the spiritual identity of others, but at the heart of our spiritual identity, there is a reality which is shared by no other created thing or being. Our individual uniqueness is rooted in the realities of the names and attributes of God. Among other things, The Sufi path is intended, God willing, to guide the individual to the full unfolding of the spiritual capacity which constitutes our uniqueness. If this happens, then we will come to know the truth and reality of whom, what, why, and how we are. According to the practitioners of the Sufi path, when we come to experience our essential identities, we'll come to the realization of certain truths about human beings. Among these truths are the following. 1. All of our attributes are borrowed from, or on loan from, the treasure house of divine names and attributes. 2. Our essential identity and nature is hidden as a mystery or secret of God within the divine names and attributes. 3. Until this Sir Ilahi or mystery of God is unveiled, we cannot know our true selves, and therefore we will not know real freedom. 4. The purpose and meaning of our lives only will be known by us with the full unfolding of our essential identity. 5. We will be incapable of properly fulfilling our duties and responsibility as God's vicegerent with respect to the rest of creation, as long as we do not know in the fullest sense possible who we are essentially. 6. If we do not realize our essential spiritual identities, we will never understand in any direct, transcendental, experiential manner that only God has reality and that divine attributes, names, actions, and effects are but manifestations made possible by the sole reality of divine essence. 7. If we do not fully experience our spiritual identities, our understanding concerning the nature of the meaning of servanthood, which is at the core of our true selves, always will be defective. You have been listening to The Mystery Song by Lisa DeBenedictis from her Tigers album, courtesy of Magnatune.com. From high atop the balconies in Carnegie Hall, you are listening to the Sufi Reflections Podcast. The title of the following story is Original Intent. Spectrum Learning Associates was a model of modern enterprise, both with respect to the diversity of its integrated line of products and services, as well as in relation to its organizational structure. Many business schools and textbooks use SLA as a paradigmatic case study of how to run a corporation. An increasing number of universities, colleges, technical institutes, high schools, and early learning facilities had adopted its varied curricular packages and also were implementing its teaching model. In addition, the company was constantly developing an array of software and technological innovations which complemented and enhanced its written materials on a variety of levels. Bonus programs, stock options, and other kinds of incentive arrangements had spurred the company to a steady increase in sales over the last decade. Furthermore, an open and flexible style of communication that encouraged employees to make a significant number of decisions without having to consult higher levels of management had thereby stimulated production, research, and company morale. With so many positive indicators synergistically combining together, why was Joe Wilson concerned? The answer was as straightforward as it was difficult to convey to ears and hearts that weren't receptive to what he had to say. Simply stated, the problem, as Joe saw it, was that the company had lost its sense of purpose, and in the process, confusion had crept into the workplace. Sales, profits, dividends, and productivity were all up. But the original spirit of the company had been jettisoned somewhere along the line. Among other things, Joe believed that increased productivity didn't automatically translate into an increase in quality, either with respect to products, services, or workmanship. When the company first started, there had been a company-wide commitment to excellence. Now, people were far less concerned with the quality of craftsmanship and workmanship than they were with promotions, pay increases, and rewards, with little consideration being given to whether the nature of the products and services being offered actually provided customers with what the latter needed, rather than with what some wunderkind in advertising tried to convince the public it needed or wanted. Indeed, more and more, hype had replaced any inclination on the parts of management to search for the truth and provide customers with accurate information about whether or not the company's products and services could deliver as advertised. Furthermore, things were moving in another disturbing direction. Although originally the organization had emphasized the importance of being good corporate neighbors, over the last 3 or 4 years, Joe had witnessed a variety of scandals unfold involving practices that were not only adversely affecting the quality of life within the communities where different branches of the company resided, but these practices were generating a large number of potential ecological problems as well. Strategies had been devised by a troika of lawyers, accountants, and board members to either escape paying taxes altogether, or which sought to create various forms of financial, legal, political, and economic intimidation of communities if the latter did not give the company an array of tax, union, and environmental concessions. Such tactics might make sense at the annual meeting of stockholders, where the amount of dividends received was the altar at which many of them worshipped. But given that the company had been founded largely on an idea of being in the business of helping people and communities improve the quality of their lives rather than just profits, Joe could only shake his head with sadness in relation to the zeitgeist which pervaded the company now. In addition, many of the latest technological breakthroughs which were being touted by the company unfortunately seemed to have a dark side to them. Not only was the physical environment at risk, but equally importantly, perhaps more so, the mental, moral, and spiritual environments of customers was being threatened by the shoddiness of the principles, techniques, methods, and ideas which were at the heart of the SLA approach to learning and education. The people in charge of research were enthusiastically committed to all manner of information processing technology. However, almost none of them had any idea of how to identify wisdom amidst the wealth of data which their technology could crunch. They had lots of theories. They lacked knowledge about what relation their theories had to reality. Cutting-edge, innovative, and heuristic were the corporate buzzwords. Truth didn't seem to be in its vocabulary. Finally, although in some ways employee morale was at an all-time high because of the high degree of local autonomy which characterized the company's management style, nonetheless, at the same time, there was an increasing amount of conflict, tension, and destructive competitiveness to which Joe had been witness, as employees often played a zero-sum game with one another. That is, there could only be one winner, and as a result, themes of self-interest and selfishness often wafted through the company corridors and offices like a toxic cloud of smog. Petty-minded company politics also often spoiled the atmosphere. All too many individuals would think nothing of sabotaging fellow employees if this would lead to career advancement. The more Joe thought about the problems facing the company, the more he got depressed. Moreover, to add insult to injury, very few people seemed to have any interest in trying to critically analyze the situation. They were too caught up in careers, power, social status, and bonuses. Originally, the company had come into existence in order to help students develop the skills and understanding necessary to become better human beings. Human beings who would be committed to the communities in which they lived, as well as the other communities that populated the larger world surrounding them. Originally, issues of truth, morality, character, identity, self-realization, and justice had been of paramount importance. Now, at the urging of his company, at least in its latest form, truth was being replaced by information. Morality was being supplanted by preoccupation with values. Character was being converted into personality. Identity had become engulfed by psychobabble. Self-realization was being transformed into the antithesis, namely ego enhancement. And justice was virtually brain dead and on life support, thanks to the kind of interpretive framework his company was promoting through its text materials and software programs dealing with the Constitution. As Joe sat at one of the tables in the cafeteria, mulling over the manner in which the workplace had strayed far from the original intent of the company's founder, another parallel issue occurred to him. Just as his company was being guided by a set of principles that was something other than the vision with which the company had begun, so too many religions seemed to have deviated significantly from their original teachings. More and more, Joe felt spirituality had been hijacked by theology, dogma, indoctrination, rigidity, exclusion, and enmity. Yet, love knows no theology. There is no dogma to kindness or generosity. Indoctrination cannot lead to understanding the truth, let alone being able to freely choose such truth. There is nothing rigid about forgiveness, tolerance, or patience. Empathy and compassion are inclusive, not exclusive. And what does peace or beneficence have to do with enmity? Like many of the employees of his company, Joe believed that all too many religious people had become preoccupied with issues of reward and punishment, heaven and hell, and not enough with commitment to excellence or to the manner in which quality of life for both the individual and the community was rooted in service to God and creation, rather than in a system of bonus incentive arrangements. In fact, if one's worship of divinity were dependent on the receiving of a reward in exchange for worship, then really, what was being sought, the reward or divinity? And if the former is the answer, then what does that say about the precise nature of one's worship, that is, who and what were being worshipped and why? Furthermore, like his company, many religions, at least in their modern format, no longer appeared to be good corporate neighbors. They often didn't seem to care about what destruction they brought upon the people and communities they were supposed to serve, or about whom they hurt, as long as their opinions, agendas, politics, and prejudices prevailed, while the accursed heretics and infidels, that is, anyone who didn't believe as they did, were smitten down by those who fancied themselves to be the agents of the divine, despite a disconcerting absence of evidence to support their allegation, other than their own self-serving testimony. Joe believed spirituality had started out as a way of helping people struggle towards experientially realizing the closeness of their relationship to divinity, as well as bringing to fruition the unique spiritual potential which had been bequeathed to each human being. Spirituality, he felt, originally had been intended to provide people with a way to improve the quality of their lives, both individually and collectively, by emphasizing the importance of qualities such as love, forgiveness, kindness, generosity, sincerity, honesty, humility, self-sacrifice, tolerance, forbearance, patience, courage, modesty, persistence, and beneficence. Joe didn't see how there could be any legitimate room for theology, dogma, indoctrination, rigidity, exclusion, and enmity in any of this. And yet, just as his company had slipped from its moorings over the years, so too spirituality seemed to have been cut adrift from the principles that traditionally had anchored it. Now, self-centeredness, cutthroat competitiveness, and zero-sum games appeared to dominate the interaction among many religious traditions, just as such things ruled Joe's company. He suspected the decline in his company's moral profile was just one of the many problematic ramifications that had arisen because of the way all too many people were pursuing religion as currently conceived, rather than as originally intended. He believed the same was probably true of many other facets of life, from politics to family life to education. The following selection is entitled The Guru. Horizons seem to expand into lands that dreams are made from, as past disappointments fade towards forgetfulness. Possibilities fuel my heart soul with high octane hope that helps me cope with doubts that, like vampires, feed off the night. Moonbeams lead down a strange way to spaces where some say light of the sun may rise in reflected human form. Ready to abandon all that preceded this moment, a sought-for future calls me to embrace uncertainty. Yearning haunts the halls of time where I have learned to deal with the problems to which real men taunt my desire to transcend. Shallow surfaces deceive. Misdirection is a key to the magic that is spun around one's eyes, ears, and mind. I only ask for the truth, but they are ruthless with words, which wrap events in pretty packages like bait on hooks. My fate wobbles in between what is said and done, by those fully mesmerized with one who remains a mystery. We write our own stories, he said, which makes me wonder why someone would betray essence in such calculated ways. I never lie is a phrase that falls from his lips like quips of a politician who rarely speaks with honesty. Wishing that the myth had been more than an empty promise, my heart spins on with the task of answering what it asks. The previous selection is entitled The Guru from the Spiritual Peaks and Valleys CD. The foregoing selection is just one of 21 compositions from that CD. If you would like to purchase a copy of Spiritual Peaks and Valleys, please go to spiritual-health.org/peaks, P-E-A-K-S with a capital P, .htm for further information. The Sufi path is not just about aspiring to spiritual understanding concerning the potential of one's inherent God-given capacity, but as well, tasawwuf should entail an application of spiritual principles to the problems and events of everyday life. Consequently, from time to time, this podcast will offer reflections on different facets of various social, political, economic, and ecological issues of the day. The purpose of these commentaries is not to induce people to pursue this or that action or policy. Rather, the intention of such commentaries is to provide food for thought, which, God willing, may serve to support responsible, moral, considered action according to one's circumstances and best understanding. For want of a better name, I refer to these occasional commentaries as White House Briefs. Although given my nature, some of the commentaries are not always so brief. The title of the following commentary is Terrorism. It is the first of a four-part series. The full title of today's commentary is Terrorism, Dissociation, and Spiritual Abuse, Part 1. You may be asking yourself the question of why you should listen to something that sounds as academic and heavy or intense as the foregoing title might seem to suggest. The shorter answer to such a question is that ignorance is a weapon that is wielded by many sides of the terrorist issue in order to hide the truth about various facets of the phenomenology and dynamics of terrorism and spiritual abuse. People who are ignorant are that much more vulnerable to being manipulated and exploited by those who use terrorism, irrespective of their side on the matter, to promote tools of violence as the way to solve problems, rather than promoting tools of faith as the best way to engage most of the difficulties facing human beings. Ignorance is not bliss, but is in fact one of the major causes of the perpetuation of the terrorist phenomenon. And those who perpetuate terrorism include not just terrorist groups, but those who believe they can conduct a successful war on terrorism, along with those who blindly support either side. All three of the foregoing elements, in other words, terrorists, those who conduct violent oppressive campaigns against terrorists, and those who blindly follow either of these approaches, all three of these foregoing elements in the terrorist equation are steeped in ignorance of one kind or another. The following commentary seeks to critically examine some of the phenomenology and dynamics surrounding terrorist activity in the hope that insight rather than ignorance may inform a person's understanding of this matter. In general, dissociation has to do with a state in which memory, consciousness, perception, identity, and understanding tend to become unconnected with one another. Usually, one of the prominent causal features of dissociation is the presence of some form of trauma, intense stress, torture, abuse, and/or threat, which pushes an individual in the direction of a phenomenological condition characterized by a combination of one or more of the following possibilities: despair, fear, terror, anxiety, alienation, derealization, that is when reality loses its sense of realness, vulnerability, loss of identity, doubt, insecurity, hopelessness, humiliation, depersonalization, that is, loss of one's sense of being a person, directionlessness, that is, absence of any plan or ideas about how to proceed in life, purposelessness, depression, a sense of rootlessness, that is, not feeling at home anywhere, demoralization, meaninglessness, lack of motivation, loss of control, and/or a sense of chaos and unpredictability concerning events. The experience of dissociation may be acute, that is, transitory in nature, or chronic, that is, more long-lasting. Moreover, the intensity of felt dissociation may vary over a continuum of possibilities, ranging from that which is relatively low-grade, although sufficiently strong to disrupt the way in which memory, identity, consciousness, perception, and understanding are normally connected to provide a relatively functionally coherent and consistent view of the world, to an intensity which is severe and completely debilitating. All forms of dissociation are experienced as being painful in essential ways, although some forms may be felt to be more painful and more essential than others. Furthermore, due to factors such as personality, individual history, culture, and so on, different people may be vulnerable to varying degrees to the manner in which circumstances are experienced as dissociative in such essential ways. One of the primary reasons for the experience of psychic and somatic pain in conjunction with dissociation is that one's essential sense of being a human is under attack. In other words, we all tend to think of being human in terms of the awareness, meaning, purpose, identity, choice, hopefulness, personhood, understanding, and sense of belonging, family, community, friends, which normally are woven into our perception of reality. However, if the force of circumstances or one's perception of the force of those circumstances undermines one's existential sense of what it is to be a human being, then one begins to enter into a realm where our ideas about ourselves, others, and reality begin to dissolve. As a result, memory, perception, identity, motivation, and awareness begin to become dysfunctional in whatever mode of glue, whether it be spiritual, emotional, conceptual, social, personal, philosophical, or mythological, which was holding things together, begins to dissolve, and as a result, one loses one's sense of integration and rootedness. Clinically speaking, DSM-4, that is, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 4th edition, identifies 5 categories which are intended to encompass the sorts of dysfunctional responses that might arise in conjunction with the experience of dissociation. These are: 1. Dissociative amnesia, a form of memory lapse which affects one's ability to remember important details about one's personal history. 2. Dissociative fugue, which is often characterized by the assumption of a new identity along with a lapse of memory concerning one's previous identity. 3. Dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple personality disorder, and a condition in which 2 or more distinct identities are believed to have arisen within one and the same person. 4. Depersonalization disorder, which is an intense, recurrent sense of having become detached from and no longer identifying with one's mental and bodily processes as being one's own. 5. Dissociative disorder not otherwise specified. This is a grab-bag classification which seeks to cover all other instances in which symptoms of dissociation exist, but which do not appear to be subsumable under any of the previous four categories. Dissociative disorders all constitute responses to the presence of felt dissociation. In one sense, all such responses are dysfunctional because they require one to lose parts of oneself in the form of lost memory, identity, awareness, perception, understanding, and integration as the price which is to be paid for being able to function at all. On the other hand, considered from another perspective, however dysfunctional dissociative disorders may be relative to one's normal way of doing things prior to the advent of felt dissociation, nonetheless, such disorders all constitute an attempt by the individual to forge a way of responding to and dealing with the intense pain of the dissociative state. Given the foregoing, I believe that terrorist activities constitute a dysfunctional response to the felt presence of dissociation. In effect, I am proposing a new category for the dissociative conditions listed in DSM-4. Furthermore, above and beyond the parts of an individual which, to varying degrees, are lost and have become separated from one another, such as identity, awareness, perception, memory, and understanding, through the choice of dysfunctional response to the felt presence of dissociation, something else has become lost in the dysfunctional responses which are expressed through terrorism. Namely, a terrorist is someone who has lost faith in the nonviolent tools which God has provided through revelation and the spiritual teachings of the prophets and saints concerning the nature of divine guidance. Dissociation does not just mark an individual's separation from memory, perception, identity, and awareness. The experience of dissociation may also induce one to lose contact with values, morality, faith, and ethical considerations. One does not have to believe in God in order to appreciate the fact that if another person does believe in God and then suddenly, due to the trauma of circumstances, becomes spiritually disoriented, the loss of contact with faith, which may be entailed by such disorientation, is likely to have a profound effect on the way in which that individual seeks to find ways of warding off the felt presence of dissociation. One does not have to believe in God to understand that if a person lives in a community or culture where religious themes play significant roles in the shaping of perception, identity, memory, and awareness, then if such an individual either loses contact with faith or perhaps never had any faith to begin with, that person is likely to couch one's coping strategy in religious terms, even if the underlying motivations are quite remote from any sort of authentic spirituality. And if one does believe in God, then the foregoing considerations are likely to be appreciated in an even more intimate way. Similarly, just because someone couches his or her rhetoric in terms like democracy, freedom, political duty, rights, and justice, this does not necessarily mean that such a person actually sincerely believes in democracy, freedom, and rights. Different cultures give expression to philosophical, political, mythological, social, and spiritual themes which some people seek to parasitically exploit to serve an agenda other than the purposes and principles actually valued by a given culture, while simultaneously having the appearance, but only the appearance, of being appropriate uses of those principles and purposes. Just as the sort of dissociative disorders noted above, in conjunction with DSM-4, all can be seen as attempts to fend off the experience of dissociation. However dysfunctional such attempts may be, so too, becoming a terrorist is a dysfunctional attempt to fend off the painful experience of dissociation. Just as the five categories of dissociative disorders noted above all give expression to dysfunctional attempts to establish a new way of trying to integrate being in the face of felt dissociation, a form of integration which can never be functional because essential parts of being have been lost or separated off from that process of integration. So too, terrorist activities are an attempt to fashion a new manner of integrating experience. And again, an attempt which can never be successful because essential parts of being have been lost or separated off from such attempts at integration. None of the foregoing is meant to excuse the acts of a terrorist, nor is any of the foregoing, nor what follows, intended to suggest that criminal penalties may not be appropriate responses to terrorist activities. After all, there are many people who may suffer from a pathological condition, and the existence of such a condition does not render the acts of those people less culpable, although these sorts of condition may or may not be mitigating factors in the assigning of punishment for such crimes. However, trying to understand the dynamics of terrorist activity should be considered to be an important step towards learning how to treat such a condition in a way that is not itself predicated on and steeped in the dynamics of dissociation and therefore equally dysfunctional. A terrorist is someone who, during his or her encounter with dissociative states, has lost contact with important facets of perception, memory, understanding, identity, awareness, and as well, moral or spiritual values. Furthermore, in the process of responding to the felt presence of dissociation, such an individual has made or has been induced to make dysfunctional choices concerning the issue of how to fashion a new sense of integrated being as a way of dealing with and fending off the felt presence of dissociation. As is the case with other individuals who choose dysfunctional, maladaptive coping strategies for dealing with the felt presence of dissociation, a terrorist is someone who has been pushed or pulled into a condition of dissociation through traumatic, stressful, and/or abusive events. When individuals, families, communities, governments, corporations, and/or nations pursue political, economic, social, religious, and militant policies which, intentionally or unintentionally, push people into dissociative states, then the former agencies help sow the seeds for terrorism. Alternatively, the foregoing comments concerning the issue of dissociation helps to explain, whether one is dealing with terrorist groups or recruitment into the military, why the best candidates for induction are people who are in their late teens and early 20s. This is so because oftentimes the lives of such people are in transition with respect to issues of purpose, meaning, identity, career, family, alienation, and values. As a result, such individuals are most at risk when it comes to being vulnerable to being induced to accept a solution for their sense of dissociation, which is wedded to the idea of a willingness to commit violence against anything which is painted as a potential means of pulling one or one's society back into dissociation. One can examine almost any set of circumstances existing in the world today or in the past where terrorist acts are perpetrated, and one invariably will find the forces of dissociation playing a very fundamental role in the etiology of the disorder known as terrorism. Whether one is considering so-called Christians who murder doctors involved with abortion clinics, or Ian Paisley's Irish Protestant movement, or the Aryan Nation, or the Irish Republican Army, or suicide bombers of Hamas, the Chechenian Liberation Movement, the Japanese group Aum Shinrikyo, Bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, the Khalistan movement of militant Sikhs, the independent struggle of Kashmir, the violence of people such as Dr. Baruch Goldstein, Yigal Amir and the Israeli settlers movement, the Rwandese Patriotic Front-led murderous rampage against Tutsi and moderate Hutu in Rwanda, the genocide in Darfur, Sudan, the Sendero Luminoso of Peru, the Contras in Nicaragua, the Balkan Wars, the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. In all of the foregoing sets of circumstance, and many more which could be cited, a variety of historical, cultural, political, religious, ethnic, racial, philosophical and or economic forces converged together that pushed or pulled people both collectively and individually into dissociative states that threatened them or were perceived to threaten them with a loss of control, purpose, meaning, identity, and stature in their lives, and as well induced a sense of alienation, anxiety, stress, fear, doubt, chaos, unpredictability, helplessness, vulnerability, insecurity, despair, humiliation, hopelessness, and or derealization with respect to events going on around them. For example, consider the 1967 Israeli defeat of the Arabs. Many Arabs refer to this defeat as al-Nakba, catastrophe. Al-Nakba alludes to something beyond just a military reversal. Indeed, the defeat was, in a sense, a symptomatic expression of something pathological in many facets of Arab affairs at the time. Corruption, tyrannical governments, dysfunctional economies, modernism gone awry, incompetent politicians, failed socialist experiments, chaotic violence, fourth-rate armies, borrowed technologies, as well as fawning, subservient relationships with the major powers of the world. The notion of Nakba, the catastrophe, is an indication of the forces, intellectual, cultural, political, social, technological, international, spiritual, and historical, which were pulling many Arabs into the currents of dissociation. The issue was not just a matter of ethnic, national, historical, racial, linguistic, military, and cultural dissociation, but spiritual dissociation as well. After all, if theirs was the true religion, then how could God permit such things to happen? This led to a lot of unanswered questions about identity, purpose, meaning, truth, character, government, society, and spirituality, which in turn pulled and pushed many Arabs further into the grip of dissociative states, states that rendered some of them vulnerable to the spiritual abuse of those who were inclined to acts of violence, and used the idea of religiously coded terrorism as the solution for reversing al-Nakba and extricating themselves from the psychic and soul-wrenching pain of their dissociative condition. Terrorism is the only dissociative disorder which seeks to push others into the same state of dissociation as the one which underlies that dysfunctional response. The purpose of terrorism is to seek, whether directly or indirectly, to induce the lives of others to become chaotic, depersonalized, derealized, alienated, fear-laden, stressful, anxious, unpredictable, insecure, meaningless, hopeless, vulnerable, purposeless, lacking in direction, depressed, despairing, filled with humiliation, and demoralized. On the one hand, the purpose of terrorism is to maximize the collateral damage of dissociation in others, the ones who the terrorist perceives have been responsible, directly or indirectly, for the presence of dissociation in his or her own lives. On the other hand, the purpose of terrorism is to seek to induce those who are perceived to be the cause of dissociation in the life of the terrorist to cease and desist with respect to those activities which are believed to have led to the presence of dissociation in the life of the terrorist. Generally speaking, although there are exceptions to this, for example, Billy Milligan, if one considers him a true case of dissociative identity disorder, generally speaking, those who suffer from the sort of dissociative disorders listed in DSM-4 do not harm others. The dysfunctional, maladaptive coping strategies that arise out of the dissociative conditions underlying those strategies are primarily geared to help the individual cope with his or her own internal sense of dissociation in terms that are self-directed rather than other-directed. In the case of terrorism, however, one of the primary driving forces being expressed through the dysfunctional, maladaptive coping strategies of a terrorist dissociative disorder is to do violence, emotional, psychological, social, physical, economic, and/or spiritual, to others. The terrorist believes that the cause of his or her felt sense of dissociation has a remedy that revolves around an external locus of control, whereas most dissociative disorders involve remedies that revolve around an internal adjustment involving memory, awareness, perception, and/or identity to the felt presence of dissociation. The terrorist generates, or is induced to generate, delusions, that is, belief systems which tend to be false and detached from actual conditions, concerning the role of the other in the etiology of the felt presence of dissociation. These delusional states are possible because of a loss of contact with the sort of integrated elements of memory, perception, identity, and awareness which are necessary for performing a reality check, a loss of contact which has been brought on by the presence of dissociative elements in the life of the terrorist. The presence of felt dissociation does not automatically lead to a dissociative disorder. Furthermore, as indicated previously, although all dissociative disorders constitute dysfunctional, maladaptive coping strategies, terrorism is only one possible response to the felt presence of dissociation. One of the factors which determines whether or not the presence of felt dissociation will lead to disparity revolves around the issue of faith. More specifically, although the rhetoric of terrorism is often imbued with themes of God, divine justice, judgment, religious truths, faith, and the like, one of the delusions from which a terrorist suffers is the belief that he or she is still in functional contact with tools of faith or morality. Despite the religious rhetoric of terrorists, violence is not a tool of faith or morality. In fact, with very limited exceptions, the presence of violence is usually a symptom of an absence of faith or morality. And this is as true for nations which collectively perpetrate violence and terrorism in the name of some delusional theory concerning God, democracy, and justice, as it is for individuals who perpetrate violence in the name of some personal, delusional form of justification. To be sure, certain acts of violence may be legitimately reconcilable with a spiritual or moral perspective within some limited context. At the same time, this is not meant to dismiss the possibility of choosing to be nonviolent, even at the cost of one's life or the life of one's loved ones. That this can also be a moral, faith-based response to the same set of circumstances. These contexts of potentially justifiable violence are far more limited and constrained than some people may suppose, and usually involve repelling, within boundaries which should not be transgressed, direct, unavoidable, unprovoked, or unjustified acts of physical aggression against one's person, one's family, or one's local community. Notwithstanding the foregoing sorts of special, limited circumstances, and perhaps not even then, as necessary as such acts may be, violence towards others cannot be considered to be a tool of faith or morality. Indeed, tools of faith such as patience, kindness, forgiveness, tolerance, love, compassion, charitableness, humility, nobility, integrity, objectivity, balance, hope, fairness, and honesty form an integral part of divine guidance across all spiritual traditions due to, among other things, the capacity of such qualities to assist a person to find alternative solutions to problems that are not violent in nature. As such, tools of faith and morality are the direct antithesis of tools of violence as ways of seeking to resolve conflict, worship divinity, submit to divine guidance, or treat others with righteousness and equitability. In many instances, the delusion that violence towards other is a way of demonstrating one's faith in, or love of, or commitment to God has been induced through a process of spiritual abuse, which is perpetrated by so-called quote-unquote leaders who wish to manipulate, deceive, and exploit people. People who are vulnerable due to an ongoing condition of dissociation to serve the non-spiritual ends of the leaders. Such leaders teach a delusional approach to life rather than an approach which is rooted in the aforementioned tools of faith. But the delusional solution which is taught constitutes a much easier and simpler, albeit spiritually and morally reprehensible, way of doing things. Acquiring tools of faith is very difficult work. Acquiring tools of violence is relatively effortless, often taking not more than a few hours, days, or weeks of one's time. Acting in accordance with tools of faith requires considerable thought, reflection, focus, insight, prayer, meditation, and wisdom concerning all sides of a problem. Acting in concert with tools of violence often requires little thought except that which is given to how to perpetrate the act. One of the primary obstacles to performing terrorist acts is the presence of faith. One of the primary techniques of spiritual charlatans, whether they call themselves sheikhs, ministers, imams, teachers, theologians, government leaders, muftis, preachers, rabbis, gurus, mujtahids, or the like, who are involved in terrorism and wish to entangle others in their violent delusions, is to undermine, corrupt, eliminate, distort, or mislead whatever faith exists in a candidate for terrorism. Candidate being defined as someone whose condition of dissociation makes them vulnerable to the development of dysfunctional, maladaptive coping strategies concerning the handling of such felt dissociation. Perhaps the best way of illustrating the connection between spiritual abuse and terrorism is to take an in-depth look at the delusional systems which are created by those who wish to induce others to commit acts of terrorism. Although the following discussion focuses on the issue of jihad, the underlying principles and ideas are applicable to virtually any context in which one person, leader, institution, group, agency, or government seeks to induce others to commit acts of violence on its behalf. The delusional dimension of the process through which a susceptible individual, for example, some but not all people who have been pushed towards dissociation, as outlined earlier, buys into or becomes shaped by a delusional system, such as terrorism, or some other relationship of undue influence, as in relation to so-called quote-unquote mystical charlatans, is an extremely important element in bridging the transformation from non-terrorist to terrorist activities. Such delusional systems give expression to three main features that are very enticing to certain people in a state of dissociation. 1. Delusional systems help an individual to escape the pain of dissociation by replacing a deep sense of alienation, fear, stress, feeling scattered, doubt, malaise, anxiety, depression, identity diffusion, and the like, with a sense of purpose, meaning, direction, identity, coherency, focus, motivation, and belonging. 2. Delusional systems offer a coping strategy, maladaptive though it may be, for resisting the pull of dissociative states, which, like vultures waiting for something to die, exist at the horizons of one's life due to prevailing circumstance. 3. Delusional systems provide a rationalized system of values, which lowers the threshold with respect to a person's willingness to commit violence against those who, according to the delusional system being touted, are perceived rightly or wrongly as having a major role to play in helping to bring about one's previous condition of dissociation. Anyone who believes that terrorists are, for the most part, inherently sociopathic monsters, that is, they are born, not made, completely misunderstands the phenomenon of terrorism. To be sure, There are certain individuals who gravitate to terrorist activities because of the presence of some form of mental pathology, such as antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, and so on. But these individuals often become quote-unquote leaders within terrorist movements, and consequently, such individuals tend to induce others to sacrifice their lives in the commission of violence rather than sacrificing their own lives. The foot soldiers of terrorism tend to be individuals who are quote-unquote rescued from a dissociative condition. There are reasons, maladaptive though these reasons may be, for allowing oneself to come under the influence of a delusional terrorist paradigm concerning the ills of the world and how to heal those maladies. Individuals from financially and socially well-to-do backgrounds who are well-educated are as vulnerable to being pulled or pushed into dissociative states as people from a background of poverty who live amidst the bottom strata of society and are poorly educated. The determining factor is not socioeconomic, but whether or not an individual is grappling with the psychic dogs of dissociation and thereby is vulnerable to the enticements of the sort of delusional systems which appear to offer a way to free himself or herself from the painful, debilitating grip of dissociation. One should try to keep the foregoing considerations in mind when listening to the commentaries on terrorism in the next three podcasts that focus in on the idea of jihad. Jihad, when construed in the sense of indiscriminate violence, gives expression to a delusional paradigm which encompasses a variety of payoffs for susceptible individuals. Some of these payoffs concern myths about the afterlife. Some of these payoffs involve the money which may be paid to one's relatives when one sacrifices one's life for the quote-unquote cause. Some of these payoffs may have to do with the adulation and respect which one believes will accrue to oneself when one has sacrificed one's life. But first and foremost, one of the major payoffs of such a delusional system is the way in which individuals in a dissociative condition are provided with a way out of that condition, not fully understanding, again, as a result of the influence of the delusional paradigm in which they are becoming entangled, that there is a huge price to be paid which dwarfs whatever payoffs may come their way. That price is the loss of their soul and any remnants of authentic faith which they may have had prior to becoming entangled in terrorist activities. A loss which is due to a reliance on the tools of violence to solve problems rather than the tools of faith. A considerable amount of time is spent in the next three commentaries examining some of the arguments which extremists, fundamentalist jihadists use to try to justify violence, as well as their selection of targets against which such violence is to be directed. By deconstructing the delusional character of the paradigm of violence, one is in a better position to develop programs and policies that are based on actual insight into some of the dynamics of the terrorist perspective, rather than based on political theologies concerning democracy, capitalism, and freedom, which unfortunately, all too frequently, are rooted in the very same kind of delusional phenomenology as the terrorists against which such theologies are aimed. It is a very seductive argument, whether this is propagated by would-be terrorists or by those who regulate the activities of military units, to claim that acts of violence are warranted by goals of truth, justice, salvation, and freedom. It is a very powerful argument, whether this is put forth by would-be terrorists or by those who regulate the activities of military units, to seek to induce people to believe that God, duty, and or honor sanctions or legitimizes violence against a given people or set of individuals. It is a very compelling argument to assert, whether this is done by would-be terrorists or by those who regulate the activities of military units, that one is engaged in a great cosmic war between the forces of good and evil, and that the side for which one is committing violence gives expression to the quote-unquote good rather than the quote-unquote evil, and consequently, this somehow sanitizes indiscriminate violence and rehabilitates it. It is a very alluring argument, whether this is made by would-be terrorists or by those who regulate the activities of military units, that all those who are labeled as, quote, evil doers, end of quote, or people of unacceptable spiritual pedigree, or people who will not submit to our way of life, deserve to be oppressed, or do not deserve due process, or are not worthy of equitable treatment. Most of the forthcoming comments in parts 2, 3, and 4 of this series on terrorism are directed specifically at those who are advocates of indiscriminate violence against people and societies that are considered to be un-Islamic, infidels, unbelievers, apostates, or insufficiently Muslim. However, the horizontal implications of the following comments are intended to extend to anyone who believes that indiscriminate violence against people, irrespective of who these people may be, is something which gives expression to civility, common decency, spiritual etiquette, or actually gives the most eloquent expression of what divinity truly wishes for humanity. Almost any spiritual or humanistic tradition can fabricate arguments justifying violence. However, almost invariably, such arguments totally distort principles by removing issues from their appropriate context, and which as well ignore the many other principles of such a tradition which come down firmly on the side of tools of faith rather than tools of violence. Please join me for part 2 of the commentary on terrorism when the Sufi Reflections 9 podcast is released, God willing, in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
The foregoing musical selection is entitled Leaving the Theater by Erin Starks from her Lines Make Walls album, courtesy of Magnatune.com, where you get to name the price and the artists directly receive half of the proceeds.
This week's edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life.
Well, that's all for this edition of the Sufi Reflections podcast. I hope you have enjoyed the program and found the various segments thought-provoking and interesting. As indicated in the introduction to this podcast, programs will be produced on a regularly irregular basis. Essentially, this means that the next edition may appear next week, or then again, there may not be another podcast for several weeks. Sufi Reflections gets done, God willing, as time permits. And unfortunately, time doesn't always permit me the degrees of freedom necessary to put programs together, which is a lot more time-consuming than the running length of any given podcast. Nonetheless, I will strive mightily to provide a new program for your listening enjoyment in the near future. Until then, Assalamu alaikum.